The number of deaths of the coronavirus continues to climb. What's the threat to South Florida? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. More than 130 deaths are linked to the coronavirus, and more than 6,000 cases are confirmed as of this morning. Miami International Airport is now starting to screen passengers. Also, there is a group of teenagers suing Governor Ron DeSantis over the issue of climate change. They claim the state is not doing enough to protect its residents.
They're not doing their legal duty, and that's why we're suing. We want them to create laws that will start to cut back on carbon emissions.
Finally, take the fascination of science and the timing of comedy, and you get stand-up science. We'll meet with comedian Shane Moss about his upcoming show here in South Florida. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. The coronavirus continues to spread throughout China with more than 6,000 cases as of this morning and 132 deaths. The CDC has set up quarantine stations at airports across the country, including at Miami International Airport. And as you heard in the news, there are a group of students from Palm Beach County who were asked to stay home from school today because they may have come into contact with someone who was from China and had flu-like symptoms. Well, they are currently being tested, by the way, for the virus. As tens of thousands of visitors travel to South Florida for this weekend's Super Bowl, how concerned should we be about the spread of the virus? Dr. Bindu Mayi is a professor of microbiology at Nova Southeastern University. She's also an infectious disease expert, and she educates students and the public health officials, about the spread of viruses like this one. Dr. Mayi, thank you so much for being with me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
How much do we know about the coronavirus and how it spreads?
We know a lot more about coronaviruses, but we don't know very much about the new virus, the new coronavirus. So coronaviruses are a family of viruses. The majority of them cause just the cold. And a cold is not harmless, but we've had viruses like SARS and MERS that have caused pneumonia and deaths in individuals. So this new virus is a lot like the SARS virus in that it causes pneumonia. But at this early stage, it's hard for us to tell if it's symptomatic, if symptomatic individuals are the only ones who transmit it, or are they contagious prior to symptoms, or how fatal is it going to be. So I think it's too early.
How much should we be paying attention to symptoms then?
We should be, because the symptoms that the new virus has, which is fever, cough, shortness of breath. Anytime you have shortness of breath, it's a little bit alarming because it could be your lungs, it could be your heart. So that needs medical attention. But other than that, the fever and respiratory symptoms, that could be so many different illnesses, bacterial or viral, that should be addressed. But in this case, more than anything else, especially as we go into Super Bowl weekend and we don't entirely know what's going on, having a good prevention approach in place is absolutely essential. So follow good cough etiquette, follow good sneeze etiquette.
The basic things we were all taught as children. The other thing, though, is when you look at the symptoms, because it's a lot like what you would have if you had the flu or fever, again, it's one of those things I'm just wondering, should I be worried every single time I see somebody sneeze?
Well, we are not quite there yet,
right.
But what does concern me, and I see this even in a crowd that should know better, I do see open mouth sneezes, open mouth coughs, and I think we should stop doing that, because the idea is when you cough, a single cough can give about 3,000 droplets. A single sneeze, an open mouth sneeze, can give about 40,000 droplets, and these could form. There was a study done at MIT that showed this could form a little turbulent cloud that could travel in a matter of seconds to minutes across the room, 26 feet away. So it's already too late when you've given this open mouth sneeze. So trap those particles. And the best way to do that is to use a handkerchief or a tissue. I personally don't even like sneezing into the crook of my elbow, because we are a culture that's social. We hug people, right? And depending on the height, you're smushed into the crook of somebody's elbow. I'm a short person, so I'm conscious of that. But so this is a little bit gross, but I sneeze into my shirt if it's coming on too quickly and I don't have the time to even grab a tissue.
Yeah. Where are we right now when it comes to vaccines? I mean, I've read a couple of things. There's a race to try to catch this.
Yes, this is so exciting. We're at a very exciting stage in science and technology. So we have what's called a platform technology, which is essentially like the foundation onto which we can plug these new viruses or new bacteria, whatever the new pathogen may be, and then churn out a vaccine in just a few months as opposed to decades. So that's where we are. And so it's entirely feasible that we may have a viable candidate.
Reading about this, though, because, mm-hmm. look, a lot of it is depending on the Chinese to share information. So, you know, are scientists around the world getting enough information so they could be, how do you work on a vaccine if it's not happening here?
Louis, that's a great question. And that's what's happening now is in direct contrast to what happened in 2002, 2003 when SARS burst onto the scene. But they are sharing information. At the very beginning, they sequenced the information of the virus, plugged it into a portal that scientists all over the world can now access. So several sequences have already been submitted, the genomic sequence, and that's the starting point.
So again, you know, because talking about SARS again, that was the disease that came, the virus that came out of China, again back in the early 2000s. There's some similarities.
Correct.
Between these two. Again, they're part of the same
family
mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
So can we look at the SARS and kind of get an idea of what might happen again, or this is totally different?
It's yes and no. Looking at SARS certainly we've learned a lot from controlling SARS, and we are essentially using the same lessons we learned in controlling SARS outbreak. We are implementing those same lessons here as far as contact tracing, as far as infection control, isolation, isolating the patients, etc. So the way SARS turned out, the coronavirus, which bats are a great reservoir for not just coronaviruses, but so many different viruses. So it made the jump from the wild horseshoe bat to a masked palm civet, which is used as a delicacy in southern China, which is where SARS originated. And from there, it jumped into humans, and then it showed human-to-human spread. So the new virus also, we think, has jumped to us from the horseshoe bat. So the latest research shows that the sequence of the new virus is 96% identical to a virus that they isolated a few years ago from a cave in China and from a horseshoe bat.
So we know it's coming from animals.
Yes.
And it's spreading into humans.
Yes.
You know, the other thing, too, is this looking at really the vulnerable part of our population, whether it's seniors, children, or people who are already are facing, you know, they're dealing with respiratory issues already. It really is dangerous for them, isn't it?
It could be, correct, yes. So, and we saw that with SARS. We saw that individuals over the age of 65 and older, more than half of them succumbed to SARS. But at any given point in time, we always have a pool of susceptible individuals, whether they're the very young, the elderly, the immunocompromised, people on chemo. To protect these individuals who are vulnerable to all infections, not just the new virus that comes along or SARS, but they're more vulnerable to even influenza. They're more vulnerable to bacterial infections, whatever it may be. The way we can protect them is by making sure the immunocompetent population, the rest of us, do our due diligence. So let us have that cough etiquette and sneeze etiquette and stop spreading.
I mentioned as well that the CDC now has set up screenings at 20 airports.
Correct.
Miami International Airport is one of them. I mean, basically, what are we doing? Are we pulling people who are coming from China or certain parts of the world, testing them, or people we think might be sick, we're testing them?
You know, just based on reading the CDC and listening to audio messages, I wasn't entirely certain. We do have a quarantine station. We've had it for a few years in Terminal D at Miami International. So my understanding is that we are screening all passengers, and if they show fever and respiratory symptoms, then we are taking them to the quarantine station and following up. That's my understanding.
Because, you know, and we don't have actually, I don't think we have any direct flights, at least not to the area in China that's at the epicenter of this, but people who are traveling around the world.
It
could travel very quickly.
Right.
This virus
can. Right.
I'm talking with Dr. Bindu Mai. She's a professor of microbiology at Nova Southeastern University and an infectious disease expert. We're discussing this ongoing spread of the coronavirus and the prevention efforts underway here in the U.S. You can go to WLRN.org to find NPR's latest reporting on the virus. But I think as we're hearing from Dr. Mai, a lot of it is just basic common sense when it comes to coughing and sneezing, and make sure you wash your hands. Miami has dealt with this sort of on a certain level. I mean, we had the Zika scare several years ago and the chikungunya virus. Is South Florida a serious concern for the spread of viruses? Because, again, we're a port city. We're a major international city.
I think with globalization, we cannot ever say, oh, this is happening in that part of the world. We don't have to worry about it here. And we certainly are quite the hub for millions of travelers every year, whether it's for tourism or education, commerce, business, whatever the case may be. So a level of surveillance, a level of vigilance is only going to help us.
When I look at those numbers, 6,000 cases, over 130 deaths. I mean, that's a lot. And now it's starting to spread to other countries, but we're just talking a handful of cases in different places. At what point do you call it an outbreak?
So at this time, it is an outbreak. Outbreak is more than the expected number of cases in a defined geographic area. When you see that spread to other countries, more than the expected number in all those other countries, then we may call it an epidemic. But at this time, it is an outbreak because we are seeing more than the expected number of cases in China.
And how is that different from a pandemic?
A pandemic would be all over the world.
Global. And, I mean, you know, when's the last time we saw something like that?
I think it was the 2009 H1N1 pandemic.
So we're not anywhere near that yet, but still something to be, we have to keep an eye on, be concerned about.
Absolutely.
A lot of questions remain about the coronavirus, in part because it's a mutation that requires more research. You kind of touched on this a little while ago. How long do you believe it's going to take for scientists to get a better understanding and, again, reach that point where we have the vaccine? Or, I mean, because it's part of this family of coronavirus that we kind of already have a grasp. Where are we right now in understanding it?
We don't have a SARS vaccine yet, but we have this new platform technology where we can plug in important bits of DNA or important bits of protein and hope to see trials. But between trials and vaccine production, there may be years, months to years. We've still cut down the time to get to that viable vaccine candidate, but to have one that works in the community in giving us a kind of immunity that is going to protect us against this virus.
So right now, the only thing we can do is separate these folks from the population.
Yes.
And I mean, really, there's not a lot more we can do just basic treatment, and that's it, right?
There is no antiviral treatment for these patients. So basically, it's supportive care. So if they're having trouble breathing, then we help them breathe. If they have a fever, we reduce the fever, things like that. But there is no drug that we can give that specifically targets the virus at this time. Although research has pointed the way towards certain potential candidates that they may be trying to use to see if it's doing anything at all, in which case we may have some potential antiviral drugs we can use.
You were talking about just simple things to think about again, and when you're coughing and sneezing. How about these masks? I mean, we see a lot of people wearing masks. Are they really useful?
It's a barrier, right? So it's a barrier against most of the droplets, maybe not all of them. So the kinds that healthcare providers use are called N95 respirator masks, which traps more than 95% of certain small-sized particles that can get into your lungs and potentially cause disease. I don't think we need those. But any barrier, I feel, is better than no barrier. But even more importantly than that, I think it's important for all of us to engage in cough etiquette, sneeze etiquette, and then make sure to wash our hands before we touch our face. So
that's the other thing, because people don't... I'm cognizant of it right now as I'm talking to you, you know, because my hands are always moving around a lot. Yeah. We touch our face a lot during the day.
Yes.
So the problem, you know, you can wear a mask and it'll block anything from coming into your nose or mouth, but... you're touching things all the time, and we're always rubbing our eyes or touching our face. That's a problem.
Yes. Yes, because you don't know what you've touched, especially in the midst. And we're still in the middle of flu season, and flu is contagious prior to symptoms appearing, right? And flu can also be deadly. It can kill the very young, the very elderly. Pregnant women don't want to get the flu. So there are individuals who shouldn't be getting the flu, right? So.
And these are all things to think about because, again, the fascinating thing is, here in Miami this week, we're hosting one of the biggest sporting events. We've got all these people here already coming into town, not just for the game, but for the parties and everything else. Things to think about, because there was an issue of a measles spread, right?
Right.
At a Super Bowl in Indianapolis.
Yes.
What happened?
Two people who attended the Super Bowl game were in the Super Bowl Village, and they stopped at a number of shops, and they already had the measles. But measles is contagious prior to symptoms appearing. So if you have a fever and rash, now you know something serious is going on, and you'll go see the doctor. But if you don't know that, and you feel as if you just have a cold, that's what it is before the rash appears, you're still out in the community. You're still going about, and if you have tickets to the Super Bowl, you're not going to miss it, right?
Exactly. So again, things to think about as you're in these crowds with a lot of people.
Right.
Just, again, basic things to think about.
Basic things, because those two individuals, they were coughing and sneezing, and that's how the virus spread.
So again, it's not to scare people, but just to understand where we are with the coronavirus. You know, a lot of this is happening in China. But again, we do have the CDC now screening people at certain airports. Just know the basics when it comes to coughing and sneezing. Wash your hands. Think about the fact of how many times you're touching your face. Make sure that you're practicing, you know, just basic hand washing as much as possible. But right now, not a time to be afraid. Let's not be scared.
Definitely not. Prevention is easy, and awareness is half the battle. So let's just be aware there's so much we can do. And our immune system really does its job, which is why, we don't even know how hard it works because we don't get sick.
Right. We'll end it on that point. And you know what? Enjoy the Super Bowl. Enjoy the game. It's the best advice we could say. We've been talking again with Dr. Bindu Mai, professor of microbiology at Nova Southeastern University. Dr. Mai, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Well, still to come, we're going to hear from one of the students who is suing the governor for not doing enough about climate change. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Several Florida students are suing Governor Ron DeSantis, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, and two state agencies for not doing enough to combat climate change. They claim their lives are endangered due to climate inaction, and it's their right to grow up in a safer environment. The lead plaintiff is Delaney Reynolds. She's a University of Miami marine science major and a local environmental activist. She joined us last week with attorney Mitch Chester, who's representing the clients in the case. Now, motions in the case are being heard more than a year and a half after the students filed the lawsuit back in April of 2018.
The lawsuit has been filed because friends and I, there's eight of us total, we basically believe that the Florida government, the governor, the commissioner of agriculture, and their cabinets are not upholding their duties that are outlined in the Florida Constitution and the public trust doctrine. Basically, within these documents, it says that the Florida government has the legal obligation to protect our environment and our public trust resources. So that's land, that's water, and we believe that it also includes the atmosphere. And so by pumping massive amounts of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere and causing the climate change crisis, they're not doing their legal duty. And that's why we're suing. We want them to create laws and plans and remedies that will start to cut back on carbon emissions.
There's no money in this. You're asking lawmakers to produce laws to deal with the problem.
Correct. We don't want any money. None of the lawyers are even getting paid. It's all pro bono. All we want is action on climate change and reducing fossil fuels.
Mr. Chester, why the courts? This is something that, one, you would think is the responsibility of the residents, the people of Florida. What we do is affecting the environment, companies. But really, isn't it up to lawmakers to make the laws? Why the court system?
If the lawmakers abrogate their responsibilities, if they don't do what they have to do to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the general population, then the courts are there to step in as almost the last resort to say, you're not doing your job and you've got to do better. You have to enforce the Constitution, which protects our atmosphere and protects against pollution. You have to also support our constitutional obligations to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the people, and they're not doing that. So the courts are there to enforce in the event that the legislature and the executive branch is not doing its job, and that's what we're saying.
Governor DeSantis, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried have argued that this lawsuit is political in nature. It's not a legal question. How do you make the case that the suit is not political?
It's right in the Constitution of Florida. Most people don't know that Florida has a Florida Constitution separate from the U.S. Constitution, but we have different articles of the Florida Constitution that talk about protecting the public trust doctrine areas like the atmosphere and the waters and so forth.
Coming back to what Delaney said, basically the lawsuit is you're asking lawmakers to take action. Can you tell me two or three things you want to see come out of this?
Well, one of the easiest is for the legislature, actually the governor and the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, Nikki Fried, to come up with a carbon sequestration inventory to see how we can reduce our carbon footprint. How can we capture carbon, even, for example, agriculturally? And there are ways to do that. And what assets of the state exist that are the most pollutants in terms of greenhouse gases? If they do those inventories, that's like doing their homework to be able to come up with the proper plan. But they still haven't come up with those inventories to understand where are the areas of our state, what segments of our state government and its assets can be used to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions.
Delaney, how did you become part of this?
So a few years ago, I actually learned about the federal lawsuit that our Children's Trust is
Juliana
involved
versus
in.
The United States.
Yes. And I read about that in the newspaper, and I thought that that would be something really interesting to bring here to Florida, because at the time when I read that, Rick Scott was our governor, and absolutely nothing was being done to address climate change. Government officials couldn't even talk about it. And so as a last resort, when you can't do anything else, you can't rely on the state, we had to take it to the courts. So I reached out to our Children's Trust and I asked them if they would be interested in doing something similar here in Florida. And they responded and said that that was actually something they were currently looking into. So after 3 years, we brought together a group of plaintiffs. We brought together a fantastic group of lawyers and we made a very solid and compelling complaint. And we filed in April of 2018.
With the other young people in this group, what can you tell me about them? Because, I mean, you have people who are really young in this group, and you don't see that often.
Right. So Levi, who is the youngest, he's 12. He's actually also a plaintiff in the federal case, and so that's how he became involved with the Florida case as well. But we all come from different parts of the state, so we all experience different issues when it comes to climate change. So while I'm experiencing the flooding down here in South Florida that we're seeing right now, Levi is also seeing the flooding, but he's also seeing the impact of hurricanes where he's from. He actually just recently had to move out of his house because it was flooding so much, and he had to move into an apartment, and he's now on the second or third story, so not on the bottom floor. Isaac lives close to Gainesville, so his family does a lot of agricultural things, and they're being impacted. Their crops are being impacted. Val Holly lives in Weston on the reservation, the Indian reservation there, and so she's experiencing all sorts of other environmental issues. So we each have our own issues that we are experiencing from climate change and our own stories to tell.
So this lawsuit was brought up under the Rick Scott administration, Mr. Chester. So now, basically, you didn't have to refile the suit. It's just when the office has changed, all these people changed, it now turns on them, on DeSantis, Nikki Fried, and so forth.
That's correct. As soon as there was a change in the administration and they were inaugurated, they basically became defendants automatically in the case. And so for the last year, since they've been inaugurated and they've taken office, we've watched very carefully to see what they've done. And for example, the Commissioner of Agriculture has come up with a climate plan that does nothing to reduce greenhouse gases. And although the governor has appointed a science officer and a resilience officer, there's still no plan to address this greenhouse gas issue.
My understanding is the Florida Energy Efficiency Conservation Act requires the Public Service Commission to set efficiency goals for utilities every 5 years and pays for conservation incentives. They allow the utilities to offer programs for LED light bulbs, attic insulation, and so forth. She also introduced a greenhouse gas reporting system, creating an inventory of greenhouse gas emissions for state-owned buildings for the first time. Are you saying that Agriculture Commissioner hasn't done enough at this point?
Not nearly enough. When you look at the campaign promises that were made on climate change, and you look at the opportunities that are proven with science to address this problem, she's only done a Band-Aid approach. What we need is a thorough approach. We're running out of time.
Delaney, I wanted to ask you about that. You mentioned a moment ago, under the Scott administration, it's true, he had never mentioned climate change, didn't want the word mentioned. He did start saying it, though, when he was running for Senate. But DeSantis, under DeSantis, very different. And as just we heard, a science officer, resilience officer, more money for Everglades restoration. Seems like he's going in a different direction. At least something better, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's definitely better. And they're great first steps, but the key word is first steps. So the only way that we are ever going to address and solve the climate change crisis is by completely eliminating the use of fossil fuels. We have to transition from an economy based on fossil fuels to one based on sustainable energy. And so while all of these mitigation efforts, resiliency efforts are important and necessary for South Florida and Florida as a whole, our long-term survival, we need to eliminate the use of fossil fuels.
I'm talking with Delaney Reynolds and attorney Mitchell Chester. Reynolds and a group of eight students are suing Governor Ron DeSantis and Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried and the state of Florida for endangering their lives because of climate change. Mr. Chester is their legal representation. You can find more on this story on our website at WLRN.org. Delaney, have you spoken to any lawmakers?
I have not, but Mitch and I were actually just talking about potentially visiting the lawmakers now the legislative session is occurring, and for all of the plaintiffs to hand them letters to talk about why we're suing and to hopefully move the case forward.
Because I'd wondered if, you know, over time since the beginning of the lawsuit, if you've had a chance to talk to lawmakers, but especially Republicans who have been the most, really been the group that's pressed hardest against any changes. But I don't know if over the last few years or so you've had that opportunity or not.
I haven't had the opportunity to speak to any of them in person, but I would definitely say that we are seeing a shift in that sort of thinking. I think that Republicans are, for the most part, very monetarily driven. And while they're seeing all these changes in Florida, for example, Miami Beach is spending $500 million to raise roads and install pumps. The city of Miami has the Miami Forever Bond, which is about $200 million towards climate change. All this money is being spent on climate change and resiliency efforts in the state of Florida, and I think that they're starting to pick up on that and realize that if they don't do something about it, then voters are going to be increasingly more frustrated with them because we have to start doing something. We don't have any more time to lose.
You know, we mentioned the federal case, the Juliana versus the United States. This was filed in 2015. A court just shot that down recently, Mr. Chester, and basically saying that the court threw it out saying basically this is an issue for Congress, not the courts. Are you worried this sets a precedent?
Actually, I'm encouraged. When you read the opinion very carefully, including the dissent, but also the majority opinion, there's a lot of very interesting things in there that I think actually help us in the Florida case. At first, when I heard that the court had decided that they wanted to dismiss the Giuliani case, I became concerned. But as I got into the actual opinion, I realized it's very helpful to our case. And so I'm encouraged by the way that there are certain things that are mentioned in that case that help us at the state constitutional level.
Delaney, I wonder if you've had the chance to speak with climate deniers and if you're seeing maybe a shift and people are changing their mind, or you've helped people change their mind.
I have met climate deniers and I have talked to them. And a lot of the times the problem is just that people are uninformed or misinformed. And so whenever I meet a climate denier, I typically start by sharing the science with them because that's what's most compelling to me. 97% of scientists agree that climate change is happening. And the graphs are scary. The predictions are scary. I will admit that. NOAA predicts that right now here in South Florida, we experience about 6 days of sunny day flooding. By 2030, we could see 80 days of sunny day flooding. By 2045, we could have 380 flooding events per year. So sometimes more than once a day during the two high tides. And that's during my lifetime. So that's a lot of water in the future. Where I live, special places all over the planet are going to disappear because of sea level rise.
See, when you talk about, and by the way, when you see climate deniers, we're talking about people who don't think human beings are having an impact on the changing climate.
Right.
When you bring up the science, though, first of all, I mean, I've read a lot of climate deniers and the science that they try to use,
right,
or what they call science to use in their arguments. But when you do that, usually what response do you get?
Typically, they're usually receptive, the ones that I've spoken to. And the ones that I haven't met yet, typically I see the majority of climate deniers are politicians in very high up positions. So, for example, our state or our country. And I think that a lot of the problem there is with special interests and groups like that, utility companies who are paying them to basically protect those companies over our environment and our planet. And so, like I said, a lot of politicians seem to be extremely monetarily driven. And so if they have money pouring directly into their pockets, they're going to do everything that they can to protect those companies who are providing them that money.
You have been very involved on this issue for many years now. You've written books. You've been working with students and young people. You've been an advocate on many levels as a speaker and did a TED Talk and so forth. Now that you're a college student, though, how has that impacted your ability to continue the work that you've been doing?
It's actually helped my ability to continue the work that I've been doing. So in school, I'm double majoring in marine science and coastal geology.
So you have less time than before.
Less time, but I'm making it work. I'm making it work. And I'm actually minoring in climate science and policy. So now I'm actually studying it as a student. And it's been really helpful because I can apply that to my climate change work and vice versa. I can apply what I do outside of school in the classroom. And it's been really cool to get to learn side by side with my own materials and from professors at UM, because it helps further not only my knowledge, but also in the lectures that I give to children all over. I can use what I'm learning in school to teach them as well. So it's actually been really great.
You're speaking to people now. What could you tell them one or two things they could do, changes they can make in their life that won't disrupt their life, but would reduce their carbon footprint and that would be useful to protecting the planet?
The easiest thing that you can do is carpooling or biking or walking places so that you don't have as many emissions from your car. That's a huge issue, especially here in Miami. We see traffic everywhere all the time. It's nonstop. And so that's a big issue when it comes to carbon pollution. So a great way to reduce your carbon footprint is by reducing the amount of time that you spend in a car, just sitting in traffic, driving from place to place. Another thing that you can do is just reduce your water consumption, compost, change your light bulbs from incandescent to LED. That actually helps a lot, believe it or not. And that's a super easy, quick fix. You just take a little trip to Home Depot, come home, replace your light bulbs, and you're done. Little things like that, just everyday things that you can change in your life that make it super easy.
And that was my conversation with Delaney Reynolds and attorney Mitch Chester. Reynolds and a group of South Florida students, again, suing the state for endangering their lives due to climate change. You can find out more on our website at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, an update on yesterday's earthquake in the Caribbean, and then an unlikely marriage of topics. How do you make science funny? That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A powerful 7.7 earthquake hit the Caribbean Sea on Tuesday. According to reports, South Florida residents in Miami and Brickell felt the quake. Like Miami resident Anna Morales, she was at the downtown Miami Brightline train station.
My office is located in the Brightline station area, so around 2 o'clock we started feeling some vibrations in our office, which isn't necessarily irregular because of the fact that we are in the Brightline station building. We sometimes feel when the train pulls in or heads out. However, at that same time, my coworker happened to mention that the building was shaking longer than normal. And at that moment, we noticed that the light fixtures were swinging back and forth pretty fast. So that's when we knew that it was something completely different than just the train pulling in and out of the station.
After the tremors, officials evacuated the Stephen P. Clark building, known as Government Center, and the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration reported that several areas of the Caribbean were under a tsunami warning. Ryan Gold is a research geologist with the United States Geological Survey.
It's not surprising to see light shaking felt at fairly significant distances, especially given the large magnitude of this earthquake.
There were no reported injuries, according to Miami police. Our news partner, the Miami Herald, reported shocks from the quake were felt throughout the Caribbean in Haiti, Cuba, Jamaica, and the Bahamas. Now, the quake was caused by a shift in the North American and Caribbean plates. As of this morning, there were no injuries or deaths reported throughout the region. Now, if you felt anything from the earthquake, you could share with us. Tell us about it. Feel free to post on our social media at WLRN Sundial or email us at sundial@wlrnnews.org. We'll continue to keep you updated if there are any changes to the story. So if I asked you to think about two things that just go together, what comes to mind? Think about it. Pen and paper, Kermit and Miss Piggy, peanut butter and jelly, science and comedy. And they do. If you can't hear it, then you need to enter the world of comedian Shane Moss. He does stand-up, but he also hosts a podcast called Here We Are, a collection of conversations with scientists. Now, his stand-up comedy, he has a series called Stand-Up Science. It's where he brings scientists to the stage. And Stand-Up Science is coming to Miami's Open Stage Club on Friday, January 31st. Joining me now from WUSF is comedian Shane Moss. Shane, great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is amazing.
I really appreciate it. And also joining us is going to be one of the scientists who's going to be on that stage with him, Dr. Lucina Udine. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Miami. Dr. Udine, great to have you. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know what, Shane, I mean, you've been a comedian for a couple of decades now, but I kind of picture like this mad
15
science.
Years. I'm 15? Not that old. Come
well,
on.
Well, yeah, that's, you've covered a couple of decades.
Yeah.
But I kind of picture like this mad scientist, like figuring out, how do I bring these two worlds together? Really, how did you do it?
Well, when I started my comedy career, I was, I would have never seen this coming. I was a little more of a traditional comedian. I did a bunch of late night stuff, Comedy Central specials, that sort of fun stuff that I'd been dreaming about since I was a kid. And the whole reason why I ignored school growing up was because I never quite understood how the things they were trying to teach me in school would ever apply to my ambitions of being a stand-up comedian. And as I developed as a comedian, I think kind of a natural progression. You catch some breaks and then you go, you have the opportunity to be a full-time comic, and then you'd be like, I want to say something important, gosh darn it. And so I was just trying to add more elevated content to my life, and at the same time I was confused about all of the horrible decisions that I've made in my life with relationships and just being irresponsible and that sort of thing. And I just found myself really digging into things like psychology and finding a lot of really interesting, funny things about seeing connections in, say, mating behavior between birds or chimps or whatever, and some of the things that I was going through in my dating life. And I was making all these funny connections, and I just had a lot of questions, and I just started emailing scientists to ask them questions, and it turns out that that scientists got a kick out of getting emails from a comedian and were writing me back, and then I just had the most amazing conversations of my life. And I was like, well, what the heck do I do with this? And I was like, I should be recording these conversations. And that's when I started my podcast, Here We Are, which I started 5.5 years ago. And I just never thought I would love anything as much as I love comedy. But it's kind of completely flipped for me. I've been obsessed with science ever since. And so I've just been trying to figure out more and more ways of putting these things together. And stand-up science is the thing that I stumbled upon about a year ago that really took off. I did 100 of these shows last year. I'll probably do more than that this year.
Bringing scientists to the stage. Dr. Udin, first of all, have you ever had any comedy experience?
Other than giving a speech at my sister's wedding a couple of years ago, it went over okay.
Well, you know what? Have you ever been approached by a comedian? Because he's writing to scientists to answer questions.
I have not. This is a first.
This is it. You know, this is interesting. Shane was telling me that, you know, for him, he didn't go to college because he wasn't a good student. But you told me, because I asked you, how did you end up a neuroscientist of all things? Because I don't know if it's something that you thought about when you were a child, but really when you were in college, how'd you do it?
I mean, honestly, it was process of elimination. When you get to college and you're 18 years old, you really have no clue. And you look at the list of majors, I just kind of crossed out the ones that were definitely no. And I landed on neuroscience. I thought that might be okay. And, you know, 4 years later, you end up finishing college. And then I really realized, again, what I didn't want to do. All my friends were going to med school. And I thought, nope, not med school. And, you know, at that point, I had to do something. So I applied to PhD programs. And, you know, it's sort of one thing led to another.
How did they approach you for this show? What did you know about you know, what Shane was doing?
I knew absolutely nothing.
It's always a weird request. You aren't the first person to be caught off guard by my email.
Well, you know, I'm open-minded. I think scientists have to be. And so I thought, comedy, science, what could go wrong? You know, let's give it a...
Lots of things could go wrong, but fortunately they don't.
You know what, Shane? You told me that these are improvised. You really don't have a plan when you go into the show like this.
Yeah, I mean, I have a fair amount of science-y comedy material that I would do in my regular act. And so sometimes there's like relevant material that I have that fits into some of the topics being discussed. Like, you know, I do the show in like 3 cities a week, so I don't have tons of time to plan. So tonight there's like a seahorse researcher, so I have some nature jokes that I can kind of crowbar in there to make them fit a little bit. But yeah, a lot of times what it is I have my academics, and I don't ask them to give stand-up comedy a whack for their first time or anything. I really, the show's half comedy, half science. But after my academics give a short overview of some of their research that they're interested in presenting, then I kind of riff on that and make it fun in my own way and kind of reframe things in the way that I put things. My favorite part of the show is really at the end. All four of us get on stage, the two academics and me and the second comedian. And that's when we open things up to a Q&A for the audience. That's when we really get to riff and have fun. And academics are always so good at answering questions on the fly. And we just have tons of fun with it. There's always a lot of big laughs and big ideas happening at the same time in that section.
I'm talking with comedian Shane Moss and Dr. Lucina Udin. Moss is hosting Stand Up Science. It's a series of shows. He's traveled the country. He's in Miami, a live show. It brings comedy and science research together. You can find more information about the event coming up Friday by going to WLRN.org. All right, Dr. Udin, you're doing some fascinating stuff right now with autism. That this is a big part of your research. So I'd imagine this is going to be something that you're going to be discussing on Friday, or hopefully so. But tell me about some of the research you're doing right now.
Yeah, we're actually very interested in children with autism, and we know that they have social difficulties, but something we don't understand quite as well is why they often engage in repetitive behaviors and are inflexible in their daily patterns. So they might want to wear yellow socks every day, or you know, have some kind of habit that is really inflexible. And what we try to understand is what are the brain systems that produce this kind of inflexible behavior? Is there anything we can do once we understand this neural circuitry to address or ameliorate this this issue for caregivers and for teachers who are, have children with autism in their classroom? So we basically use MRI, we use magnetic resonance imaging to sort of peek into the brains of kids while they're doing these kinds of decision-making tasks. And we're probing their flexible behaviors while they're in the MRI so that we can better understand exactly what's going on in their heads and how we can better treat them.
So you're, I mean, you're looking right now for, you know, parents, families to be part of the study.
Mm-hmm.
So you're, you know, but do you, are you asking for parents who know their child is on the spectrum, a certain part of the spectrum?
Actually, what we're looking for is anyone with kids between the ages of 9 and 12. And in fact, if you have a typically developing kid, that's great too, because we need to sort of compare the groups and see sort of where the differences lie. So if you have a child between the ages of 9 and 12 who just wants to come in and get an MRI and take a picture of their brain, then we welcome that too. But if you have a child who you know or suspect is on the autism spectrum, we do assessments. We also have referrals for lots of local organizations through the Center for Autism and Related Disabilities at the University of Miami.
You know, this is a topic, by the way, that it is very impassioned with parents when you talk about this. Mm-hmm. I wonder how many people come up to you and then they just want to start talking and asking questions about, where, you know, autism and how it starts and how do kids get it.
Exactly. It's been on the rise. I mean, the latest estimates suggest that 1 in 60 children are diagnosed with autism in the U.S. now. And we don't know much about how it arises. We think there's a combination of genetics and environmental factors, but really it's not clear cut what exactly leads to autism. And that's why we do this research, is to get more insight to help people in their day-to-day lives. And we actually have a Facebook page. It's U Miami Brain Development, where you can see some of the things that we've been working on. You can sign up for a study or sign your children up for a study and visit us at University of Miami.
Shane, this is a topic that's, I mean, like I said, it's a controversial topic, and parents get, I mean, they get really intense when they talk about this. How do you bring comedy into this?
Yeah, so this is one of the fun things that I get to do, is figure out those, you know, this is a very serious topic. I mean, usually what I just to give a sense of like kind of what runs through my mind in a situation like this, I kind of talk about my personal issues of some things that I went through as a kid. I was diagnosed with ADD. That was before the H, by the way. You had to, I was in rural Wisconsin in the early 90s. You had to earn ADD. Like, you really had to be one of the biggest troublemakers in the class. And I also later on in life got diagnosed with as bipolar, as manic depressive, and it's something that that, you know, has impacted my life. I care about, and I have a lot of great material about it. And at the same time, it's still, you know, taking the subject seriously, just talking about it in a fun way. And what I love about having topics like this on is it really raises the stakes. Like, this is, not only is this fun, not only are you going to learn something, but it's also important. And there's so much. Most, if you go to your regular comedy club, you're going to have like a lot of drinking jokes and sex jokes and everything like that. And that's all fun. And everyone likes to turn off their brain a little bit and have some drinks and forget about their tough day at work.
Yeah, you know, I wondered about your audiences, because it's like, look, they go in for comedy, but this is different. This is, it's like you have TED Talks meets comedy. So what are your audiences expecting exactly?
Well, I'm great at marketing, because I've had a number of good marketers on my podcast and have learned quite a bit over the years, and have a whole team behind this, making sure that we target the kind of people that are both interested in comedy and things like TED Talks, and are naturally inquisitive people. So it's not like I'm just going into a comedy club on a Saturday date night and then dropping this on a bunch of people who aren't expecting to hear a couple science talks, because that that probably wouldn't be the easiest environment in the world. But the people that do come out to the show are people that are really naturally inquisitive people that like to have fun and like to be entertained, but they want something with a little more substance. And those people are really, really underserved in the live entertainment market. And so, you know, these are people that are pro science, you know.
There's not.
I heard you talking about climate deniers earlier. You're not going to hear my audience. You're not going to get a lot of climate deniers in my audience. You know, the show's called Stand Up Science. There's like a thorough description all about what it is, and a lot of people do show up being like, "What? What is this show? How are they combining science and comedy? We're going to hear science talks and then comedy. How does this go together?"
Yeah.
And most people come out of this out of just like confused curiosity. Check it out. And then they see how well it actually mixes together. Comedians and scientists do so much of the same thing. Comedians just drink a little heavier.
There you go.
But
I've had
plenty of drinks with scientists as well. That may not be true. But, you know, comedians are always doing observational humor and trying to pick apart some of the underlying patterns.
Let me jump in. Yep. Dr. Udine, after all this, you know what you're going to be doing? Are you ready?
I'm a little scared now, but I'm willing to give it a shot.
He is Shane Moss. Again, he hosts Stand Up Science. There's a show coming this Friday. Find out more about it on our website, WLRN.org. Also, we heard from Dr. Lucina Udine from the University of Miami. Shane, thank you so much. Break a leg.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, and that's our program for this Wednesday, January 29th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, Dixie Highway is one of the oldest roadways in the country, but there have been some concerns about its name, and Miami-Dade commissioners have recently introduced legislation to rename the highway. The current name comes from the Mason-Dixon line, which separated slave-owned states from free soil states. Do you think the name should change? Give us a call, or I should say text us, the word hello to 305-602-2646. That's text us the word hello to 305-602-2646. Let us know what you think about that. That's coming up tomorrow on the program. We're also going to hear from the mayor of Miami Gardens because the Super Bowl is in his city, but how much of the attention is actually on Miami Gardens? We'll talk to him tomorrow about that. And don't forget, we got a book club. Find us on Facebook, Sundial Book Club. Let's go ahead and tell you what book we're going to be reading for February. We've been reading Mothers of Sparta for January. For February, we're going to be reading Craig Pittman's new book, Cat Tail. Go to the Facebook page, learn more about it, and let us know what you think about any of the books that we've been reading. We always love to hear your thoughts. That's Sundial for today. We're on tomorrow. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.